How Not to Be Secular, Reading Charles Taylor, James K. A. Smith, Eerdmans, 2014, 139 pages, paperback. A book summary from Books at a Glance. About the author. James K. A. Smith is professor of philosophy at Calvin College, where he also holds the Biker Chair in Applied Reform Theology and Worldview. He is the award-winning author of a number of books, including Who's Afraid of Postmodernism, Thinking in Tongues, Desiring the Kingdom, and Imagining the Kingdom, How Worship Works. He also serves as the editor of Comment magazine. Overview. Smith pursues two goals in writing this homage to philosopher Charles Taylor. First, Smith provides a concise summary and commentary of Taylor's daunting book, A Secular Age. Second, Smith wishes to make Taylor's insights for our secular present more accessible, help Christians apply those insights, and encourage skeptics to seriously consider the weight of them. Table of Contents. Preface. Introduction. Our Cross-Pressured Present, Inhabiting a Secular Age. Chapter 1. Reforming Belief, the Secular as Modern Accomplishment. Chapter 2. The Religious Path to Exclusive Humanism, From Deism to Atheism. Chapter 3. The Malaise of Immanence, the Feel of a Secular Age. Chapter 4. Contesting the Secularization Thesis. Chapter 5. How Not to Live in a Secular Age. Conclusions, Conversions. Glossary. Name Index. Subject Index. Summary. Introduction. Our Cross-Pressured Present, Inhabiting a Secular Age. Smith compares Taylor's A Secular Age to a relief map of our secular present. Unlike a road atlas that too neatly and flatly outlines the terrain in intellectual and partisan terms, a relief map takes account of the wilderness between the roads and the feel of the country culture we are in. A relief map observes how terrain bleeds over into other regions. As such, our secular age haunts unbelief with yearnings of transcendence and makes belief hard to maintain in the face of the all-consuming now, what Taylor describes as the imminent frame. As Smith states, most of us live in this cross-pressured space where both our agnosticism and our devotion are mutually haunted and haunting. At this point, Smith, like Taylor, does not pursue this perspective of the secular with philosophical analysis, but with literary analysis. Smith interacts with artists and their works, such as Julian Barnes, Flannery O'Connor, and David Foster Wallace, to demonstrate how both belief and unbelief are experienced as contested and haunted. Having introduced us to the angst of the present, Smith summarizes Taylor's way of explaining how we got here along three lines. First, we must ask the right questions. Secularism should not be explained by what people believe as much as with what is believable, i.e., what are the conditions and plausibility structures that make secularism a livable option. Second, Taylor distinguishes between three different definitions of secularism. Secularism defines the pre-modern dualism between the secular temporal and the sacred eternal. Secularism also defines the Enlightenment ideal of a non-sectarian space driven by the secularization theory that religious belief withers as society undergoes progressive modernization. Taylor's unique contribution is a third definition, secularism, the postmodern result in which neither belief nor unbelief wither away, but exist in uneasy tension. Finally, an explanation of the rise of secularism should be packaged as a narrative in order to counter the assumed narrative of the secularization theory noted above, and to help us sympathize and immerse ourselves in what the transition from a transcendent world, Christendom, to an immanent world felt like, secularism. Chapter 1. Reforming Belief, the Secular as Modern Accomplishment. Taylor's analysis of our secular situation first looks back at what made disbelief unthinkable before the modern era. Taylor lists three assumed truths, truths simply taken for granted and rarely considered, that had to be overturned to make secularism possible. Number one, the natural world was a sign that pointed beyond itself to what was more than nature. Number two, human society itself was also a symbol pointing beyond itself to a heavenly kingdom. Number three, people lived in an enchanted world, a world charged with presences that was open and vulnerable, not closed and self-sufficient. In following sections, Smith summarizes five ways Taylor believes these givens were compromised. Number one, meaning was transferred from the world to the individual mind, creating a buffer zone that isolated the self from the world. Number two, this step being made, society as a place where individuals find and derive meaning broke down. Private space and private belief became possible. Number three, the modern world, in an attempt to resolve the medieval tension between the sacred and secular, simply lowered the bar for what counted for human flourishing. Of this world, preoccupation developed. Number four, time became defined as purely chronological rather than typological. Number five, the cosmos involving multiple levels of reality was flattened out into the universe in which everything occurs on only one level of reality, the physical. Smith moves on to discuss the causes Taylor believes brought about these shifts. All the varied ways and movements that came together to create modernity can be summarized under the heading of reform. At the heart of all reform movements was a desire to overcome the medieval tension between the sacred, pursued by the priestly caste, and the secular, the masses who lived paycheck to paycheck. For instance, Taylor sees the Protestant Reformation as resolving this tension in favor of the sacred by insisting on the priesthood of all believers. The unsustainability of this quest led to its opposite, the swing toward the secular and the pursuit of a lowest common denominator for human flourishing. The Protestant Reformation was just one among many reform movements, and not all of them made modernism as we know it a necessary development. Yet all of them together, and in the way they were put together, did create a context that challenged and finally overthrew the enchanted world of Christendom. Chapter 2. The Religious Path to Exclusive Humanism, From Deism to Atheism. The disestablishment of Christendom and its enchanted world was not enough to make a secular world the default position. Secularism had to offer a constructive and alternative world to replace the old transcendent order. The development of this alternative locus of secular meaning is explored in this chapter. Taylor notes three ways secularism developed the purpose, meaning, or moral fullness necessary to positively replace Christendom. Number one, God's providential purposes were reduced from an eternal and redemptive telos to the purpose of maintaining the economic system of mutual benefit. God had no higher purpose than creating a world where everyone got along and enjoyed themselves. Number two, having reduced the scope of God's providence to this worldly concerns, God's design becomes knowable and discoverable by the powers of human reason. This intellectual Pelagianism gave humanity the dignity of constructing its own reality. Number three, the cumulative effect was to relocate salvation away from communion with God in the eschaton to self-realization within the secular economy. The way the churches responded apologetically to these changes only reinforced and made credible the possibility of moral fullness without the transcendent. In the 17th century milieu of limitless rationalism, many apologists' attempts to unravel every mystery of the faith for the sake of secularists who demanded nothing less, the flagship example being the burgeoning interest in theodicy at the time. The attempt to answer secularism on its own terms only destroyed Christianity's chances of holding it back. Writing on the theological shift that made secularism thinkable was a political shift that made secularism livable. Taylor sees in the American experiment the wedding of a tamed and distant God to a political order that takes exclusive theological claims as inconsequential to civic life. Smith notes that most people involved in this project did not lament the eclipse of the transcendent order, but celebrated it because humanity was empowered with the ability to mold and shape the world order as they saw fit. Chapter 3, The Meles of Immanence, The Feel of a Secular Age. In this chapter, Smith summarizes part 3 of Taylor's book, where he studies the existential experience of living in a secular age that has made unbelief plausible, though not guaranteed. Taylor rejects the secularization theory that holds that rationalism will continue to erode traditional belief with technological and political progress. Instead, Taylor sees an ongoing contest, a war of attrition, between belief and unbelief for the foreseeable future. This dialectic between belief and unbelief is captured by Taylor's phrase, the Nova Effect. The multiplicity of belief systems, spiritualities, and sources of meaning have exploded in our secular age. Not only are there many options, the very presence of other options always applies a cross-pressure of doubt on whatever beliefs one happens to adopt. The multiplicity of options belies our search for transcendence, which is both freeing and nerve-wracking. We experience a sense of loss or malaise in the wake of such disenchantment. Smith next summarizes a few ways that both secularism and Orthodox Christianity experience nagging doubts as a result of these cross-pressures. For the latter, Taylor points again to the symptom of theodicy as a burning issue in the modern era. Given our ability to comprehend the universe, we ought to be able to explain the causes of suffering. Traditional religions have always had recourse to mystery here, but such a category is deeply unsatisfying to the modern mind. The natural catastrophe that struck Lisbon in 1755 was the tipping point of this change. Previously, such an event would have yielded lament, but from this point on, such catastrophes produce the search for a theodicy, a religious search that has no satisfying conclusion or currency in the modern era. For secularism, the very demand for an answer to everything has left the modern soul wondering if there is not something more. The flatness of the world is most often felt with particular force in rites of passage, birth, marriage, death. We continue to feel a pressure and need to mark it somehow. Despite secularism's attempts to exorcise the ghosts of transcendence, most modern people cannot help continuing to feel or desire their return at these crucial moments in their lives. Taylor does not want to insist this is the way all secular people feel, for which reason he uses the phrase, "We feel something may have been lost," but this malaise is pervasive enough to rise to the level of a bankable pattern. How secular people deal with this malaise is quite interesting. One particular method, Taylor notes, is the path of romanticism. Modern people experience and enjoy art in a particularly romantic way. That is, having divorced art from public orders of meaning, each artist must create his own symbols. Once separated from a liturgical context, art becomes an experience in and for itself. Given secularization, we can experience the mystery of art without its implications. Art in the secular age creates a place to go for modern unbelief without having to settle for the utterly flattened world of mechanism or utilitarianism, but also without having to return to religion proper. Chapter 4, Contesting the Secularization Thesis. In this chapter, Smith expands on Taylor's attempt to challenge the secularization theory with his own retelling of modern history. The continuing interest and growth of spiritual consciousness and religious devotion is conspicuously left unexplained by the secularization theory. Taylor may agree with the facts on the ground that religious participation has declined, but the religious or spiritual impulse has not. This latter phenomena has not diminished. It has simply been transformed or redirected in the modern era. A major failing of the secularization theory is its own presuppositions about what constitutes the secular. Taylor notes three core beliefs of the theory. Number 1, science has proved religion false. Number 2, religion is irrelevant in light of technological advancement. Number 3, religion was based on external authority, but the rise of modern democracy with its concomitant individualism makes that crutch unnecessary. The problem with this construal is that it assumes religion is simply a matter of belief in supernatural entities, with secularism being the opposite, rather than defining religion as also a true motivator for human action. In other words, religion is just as much about a way of life as it is about the metaphysical makeup of the universe. It's a means whereby we find meaning beyond our natural interests in survival, prosperity, and cultural power. This component Taylor calls the transformative perspective, and this dynamic of spiritual life, conscientiously religious or not, modern or not, escapes the explanatory power of the secularization theory. Taylor's alternative secularization theory better accounts for the continuing experience of religiosity and spirituality. And to prove it, he offers a quick survey of how unbelief among the elite in the 18th century spread to mass secularization by the 21st century. Charting the eclipse of the transcendent through three eras, the Ancien Régime, pre-1800, the Age of Mobilization, 1800 to 1960, and the Age of Authenticity, 1960 to present, Taylor names expressive individualism as the new religious mindset, whereby people find meaning and transcendence beyond human flourishing. Spirituality in the milieu of expressive individualism is conceived as a personal quest that everyone must make and end for themselves. Part of Taylor's more nuanced definition of secularization is its ability to adjudicate the supposed war between faith and reason, the sacred and the secular. Rather than view secularization as nothing but the bane of traditional religion, the questing nature of modern life may just as well lead many to the embrace of Christianity. There are undeniable gains that came with secularization, and we shouldn't forget the spiritual costs of various kinds of forced conformity that were present under the Christendom. Chapter 5. How Not to Live in a Secular Age. Smith further pursues Taylor's dismantling of the pretensions of the secularization theory, or the secular narrative, in this chapter. Although it is impossible for believers and unbelievers alike to escape the imminent frame our modern world has constructed, we do have a choice whether we think this frame is open or closed to transcendence, whether this world can still be haunted by the real ghosts of transcendence. We may all be born into a world we assume in natural terms, but such a world does not in itself demand a closed natural order. Those who recognize an openness to our imminent frame, both religious and non-religious alike, understand their perspective to be a take on the world. Those who do not recognize an openness, who deny the imminent frame, religious fundamentalists, or who only affirm the imminent frame, the new atheists, assert their spin on the world. So what tips one secular individual to recognize his perspective as just a take on the world, the imminent frame as open, and another to assert his perspective as the only option available, the imminent frame as closed? Taylor thinks that what makes closed secularism so plausible for many has little to do with scientific progress or evidence, but with a compelling epistemological narrative. In particular, the Enlightenment development of the self as the locus of meaning by such philosophers as Descartes, Locke, and Hume is spun as a discovery of what humans have always been. It was a demythologizing project, rather than seen for what it actually was, the construction of a new worldview. Coupled with this discovery narrative is the moral force that lies behind it, namely, the coming-of-age metaphor of adulthood, having the courage to resist the comforting enchantments of childhood. This narrative masks the fact that conversion to closed secularism is simply the transfer of authority to a new, compelling story rather than the achievement of intellectual independence. On the plane shared by the religious and non-religious alike, what makes the imminent frame of our secular world appear open to transcendence? At this point, Taylor begins moving on the offensive by suggesting that our unnerved experience of the world, cross pressures, demands this openness. He locates three areas where closed secularism is found wanting. Number one, agency. The sense that we aren't just determined, that we are active, building, creating, shaping agents. Number two, ethics. We have higher spiritual and ethical motives that don't reduce to biological instinct or base drives. Number three, aesthetics. Art and nature moves us because of a sense of meaning. These are not just differential responses to pleasure. Taylor makes the important insight that both religious life and secular life are subject to tensions that are difficult, if not impossible, to resolve. many of the problems attributed to traditional religion are equally problematic for closed secularism. For instance, the modern move away from sin to sickness has exchanged priests for therapists, and has done so in a way that explains away rather than faces the experience of guilt and shame. On this score, the religion of a God wroth at sin was never the opiate of the masses. It was never a comforting delusion. Another example is the critique leveled at Christianity that it simultaneously degrades normal human life with aspirations for heaven while naively assuming that our world can be improved despite the natural constraints of the human condition. This dilemma, in which denying one seems to thrust one onto the horns of the other critique, Taylor described as the maximal demand, that is, worldviews of transcendence demand an otherworldly piety that is both impossible to achieve and too optimistic about human potential, with or without supernatural grace. Yet Taylor insists that the horns of this dilemma are felt within closed secularism as well. Its ideals are no less quixotic. Think of the socialist projects of the 20th century, and its assumptions about human nature as subject to purely environmental forces is nothing less than degrading. At least for Christianity, these tensions are ultimately resolved eschatologically, but this is not an option available to closed secularism. In following sections, Smith covers Taylor's take on how secularism and Christianity respond to the maximal demand, particularly from the angle of how either worldview motivates ethical action. For instance, whereas Christianity has capital to make sense of sacrifice and to process violence, secularism, if it is consistent, only has evolutionary biology with its extreme reductionisms to offer. Similarly, both secularism and Christianity feel the need to respond to evil and injustice, but secularism has no inherent restraints from turning its good intentions into utopian tyrannies, smug elitism, or guilt-ridden failed attempts to change the world. Taylor suggests that secular ethical theory, with no higher good than human perfectibility, inevitably encourages hypocrisy. While I'm motivated to help the poor and vulnerable and even the undeserving because of their inherent dignity, I'm at the same time quietly patting myself on the back, recognizing my moral superiority. So over time, it becomes frustrating that these other humans do not exhibit the same enlightened other regard. What's wrong with these people? Christianity lacks confidence in humankind's limitless potential and therefore is more chastened about its ability to effect change while also allowing room for compassionately loving the unlovable. Copyright 2014, Books at a Glance. Books at a Glance book summaries are available by subscription only, and except for brief quotes, may not be reproduced, in whole or in part, without express written permission.